whiskey is a Gaelic word, which, being rather roughly translated, means water of life. Or, perhaps more accurately, lively water. It's a surprisingly recent concoction, as the history of fermentation goes, and only made its first appearance in the 15th century as a medicinal prescription. But on the frontier of the early Republic, the making and selling of whiskey was a major business, chiefly because it allowed farmers who grew surpluses of wheat to convert them into a liquid and easily storable form. At that time, wrote the Pennsylvania lawyer George Dallas Albert, wheat was so plentiful and of so little value that it was the custom to grind the best quality and feed it to the cattle. And as for rye, corn, and barley, it would bring no price for man or beast. The only way, therefore, for the inhabitants to obtain a little money to carry on their farming and to purchase a few needful commodities was by distilling the grain and sending it down the river or over the mountains. Given that specie, hard coin, was as difficult to find in the Appalachian backcountry as it was in Daniel Shea's western Massachusetts, whiskey became the coin of the frontier realm. A gallon of whiskey could go for a half dollar in the West, and double that in the East, at a time when a harvest of rye might get no more than 40 cents a bushel. A comparable bushel of wheat could yield 3 gallons of whiskey, and a horse carrying 2 8-gallon kegs could transport $16 worth of the stuff to market. And unlike specie, whiskey could also be enjoyed as well. It was good for fevers. It was good for a decline, wrote Albert. It was good for ague. It was good for snake bites. There was nothing named in the materia medica, but old whiskey possessed some of its curative properties. Which is why, when Western Pennsylvania farmers first learned that Alexander Hamilton's report on the public credit was proposing to fund the national government's debt on the back of an excise tax on whiskey, the first response was wrath as hot and vehement as the whiskey itself. Why was whiskey being singled out for taxation? And why was this tax necessary at all? Remember that an excise tax, whether in the form of a fee or a license or a value-added levy, is a direct tax. Unlike tariffs, which are levied on goods imported from abroad and extracted before the goods actually pass into American hands, an excise tax is domestic, internal. And the levying of internal taxes, as opposed to external taxes like tariffs, was what had been at issue in the 1760s between Britain and America. The Stamp Act, which had caused so much turmoil before its repeal in 1766, was an excise tax. So were all the other attempts at taxing the internal economy of the colonies without the agreement of the colonial legislatures. And so one might as well say that the idea of levying an excise was at root the cause of the revolution itself. As the English poet Andrew Marvell had written, excise taxes were a monster. 1,000 hands she has, 1,000 eyes, breaks into shops and into cellars pries, chops off the piece where'er she closed the jaw, else swallows all down her indented maw. She stalks all day in streets concealed from sight, and flies like bats with leathern wings at night. So it was not any particular fondness for inebriation which set off the second great Shays-like uprising in the life of the new republic in the summer of 1794, but from a fury respecting their rights, wrote Joseph Smith, a Presbyterian missionary, and an impression that they were wrongfully and oppressively taxed in the very article which alone they could turn to account in trade and commerce, and thereby secure to themselves and their families the very necessaries of life. If, back in old Puritan days, John Winthrop, the governor of the Massachusetts, had imagined that Boston would become a city upon a hill for all the world to admire, the Scots-Irish and German immigrants who poured across the Susquehanna, down the Shenandoah, and across the Appalachians to the great confluence of the Ohio, Allegheny, and Monongahela rivers at Pittsburgh, imagined that they had found the New Jerusalem. The region of which Pittsburgh is the center is one of the most beautiful in the world, enthused one admirer. It resembles the Vale of Kashmir, the Scripture Eden, or paradise. When Pittsburgh lawyer Hugh Brackenridge paid a call on the elderly revolutionary veteran, Herman Husband, the one-time preacher and politician unveiled for him a vision of the glades of the Allegheny, the four counties of Westmoreland, Fayette, Washington, and Allegheny, and quite literally identified western Pennsylvania as the new heavens and the new earth. He had then just finished a commentary on a part of the prophet Ezekiel, Brackenridge recalled. It was the vision of the temple, the walls, the gates, the sea of glass. Divines had heretofore interpreted it of the New Jerusalem, but he conceived it to apply to the Western country. The walls were the mountains, the gates, the gaps in them by which the roads pass, and the sea of glass, the lakes on the west of us. No one, however, anticipates taxes in paradise. When Robert Johnson, the first federal revenue officer appointed for Washington and Allegheny counties, arrived in 1791, he was attacked, tarred, and feathered by persons of the lowest class. Public meetings in Pittsburgh in 1792 adopted defiant resolutions, modeled on the old Stamp Act protest, and promising to withhold all aid, support, or comfort from excise collectors. Their representatives in the Pennsylvania Assembly adopted still more resolutions denouncing the excise. Hamilton was flabbergasted. The excise could be easily passed on by the producer of the whiskey to the consumers, unless the producers proposed to drink all of their whiskey themselves. Surely, he wrote, there can surely be nothing in the nature of an internal duty on a consumable commodity more incompatible with liberty than in that of an external duty on a like commodity. Washington was convinced that the opposition was being ginned up by demagogues, by speeches and public meetings, and issued a cease and desist proclamation against certain violent and unwarrantable proceedings tending to obstruct the operation of the laws of the United States for raising a revenue upon spirits distilled within the same. But Congress acted to obviate causes of objection by reducing the amount of the tax in May 1792 from 9 cents to 7 cents a gallon. And Washington, who was responsible for appointing the collectors, struggled to appease the backcountry opposition on the subject of the revenue on distilled spirits by reorganizing the administrative districts of the collectors. They might all have spared themselves the trouble. The unrest only spread from Pennsylvania to Western Virginia, the Carolinas, and inland Georgia. And it did not take Washington or Hamilton long to decide where to lay the blame or what to do about it. The elections in the fall of 1792 had not produced any noticeable backlash against Hamilton's policies, but they had not made dissent disappear either. On April 11, 1793, the Germans of Philadelphia announced their creation of a political club whose goal would be to lend advice and watchfulness to Republican government, that its principles may remain incorrupt. 6 weeks later, an even larger meeting in Philadelphia incorporated itself as the Democratic Society of Pennsylvania, inspired by the successive revolutions of America and France. The new Democratic Society promised to discuss without fear the conduct of the public servants in every department of the government, which was clearly a euphemism for Hamilton, and to aid and approve those men and measures which have an influence in promoting the prosperity of the Commonwealth. The two Philadelphia clubs were followed in short order by the organization of 42 more clubs, known variously as Republican or Democratic Republican or United Freemen Societies, from Massachusetts to Georgia, with memberships varying in size from a dozen to 400. The members were largely working men and artisans, and anyone who, like the Democratic Society of New York, blamed commerce, banking, and manufacturing for introducing corrupt principles and abandoned politics injurious to the morals of the state. And they were not shy about the tactics they employed. One of Hamilton's allies in Congress was threatened by 15 Republicans and Boys of Liberty who were pledged to extirpate Tories, and in his case, to mangle his body. William Finley was a particularly sharp example of one of the new self-styled Republicans. Findlay had immigrated to Pennsylvania from Northern Ireland in 1763, served as a private in the militia in the Revolution. He was a weaver by trade, but he had a voracious appetite for teaching himself by reading, and soon was elected to the Pennsylvania Assembly as an energetic supporter of the 1776 Constitution and a determined enemy of Robert Morris's Bank of North America. The human soul is affected by wealth, Findlay declared, by its expectations and by its fears. And he told Robert Morris, in no uncertain terms, that Morris had no greater claim of special privilege for his 100,000 pounds than I have for my 5 pounds. Findlay sat in the Pennsylvania Ratifying Convention as an opponent of the Constitution, declaring that the powers given to the federal body for imposing internal taxation will necessarily destroy the state sovereignties, for there cannot exist two independent sovereign taxing powers in the same community, and the strongest will, of course, annihilate the weaker. A craggy-faced, high-cheeked Presbyterian, Findlay was not, said George Albert, much of a public speaker. But he was a fluent talker, and his strength lay in the power with which he controlled the people by going to them while they were at work in the field, treating them to a glass of grog, and giving a push at a house raising. In 1790, Findlay was elected to Congress to represent Western Pennsylvania, where he made no claim to virtuous Republican impartiality. His constituents have a right to advocate their own cause, and he had a right to think of their votes accordingly. He made himself a nuisance to Alexander Hamilton, and he was one of three representatives who wrote the resolutions demanding Hamilton's resignation in 1792. And he embraced the new Republican societies as a vehicle for political strategy. By acting in concert and holding a correspondence with each other, men of like mind and like program could prevail even if they only spoke for one out of every four voters. The societies were the last stage in the emergence of that bane of all virtuous Republicans, a political party. Even if it did take economic virtue as its aim and Republican as its name. Madison had already bolted in this direction in his essays for Freneau's National Gazette. Jefferson soon followed. They did not actually join the societies, but then again, they did not need to, so long as the societies were calling for a radical change of measures and denying the continuance of our confidence in such members of the legislative body as have an interest distinct from that of the people. Just how radical this change might be was indicated first by the repeated assertions of the Republican societies that the interests of the American and French revolutions were bound together, and then by what was happening in the French Revolution. Once the unhappy King of France, Louis XVI, was executed by the revolutionaries in January 1793, aristocratic Europe, England, Spain, Prussia, Austria, declared war on the French. The revolutionaries responded not only with the paranoid reign of terror, but with a reign of cultural silliness, which would have been laughable had it not been promoted with such deadly seriousness by the most radical of the revolutionary factions, the Jacobins. A new set of public revolutionary festivals, such as the Feast of Unity and Indivisibility in August 1793, replaced the old religious holidays. Christianity was outlawed in favor of a cult of the supreme being. The calendar was rewritten to create a week of 10 rather than 7 days, and renaming the months. Brumaire, the month of fog. Thermidor, the month of heat. They even proposed to recalculate the years from the official abolition of the monarchy. 1792 would thus become the year 1, 1793 the year 2, 1794 the year 3, and so on. Overshadowing anyone who smirked at these innovations was a new device for execution, the guillotine. None of this might have done more than amuse American observers until the behavior of the new French revolutionary emissary to America began to suggest that the French had plans to export their brand of revolutionary fervor to the American Republic. Edmond Charles Genet was the son of a minor diplomatic official in the government of Louis XVI and would probably have gone on to become a similarly minor diplomatic official himself, had not the revolution removed the king. Genet was a survivor. He promptly allied himself with the Girondist faction of the revolutionaries. And in January of 1793, while the Girondists still held power in the revolution, Genet was dispatched to the United States as the revolution's new minister plenipotentiary. His instructions were peculiar. The embattled French revolutionaries directed him, 1, to recruit by fair means or foul any French-speaking inhabitants of North America, from Louisiana to Canada, as volunteers for an expedition against the Spanish along the Mississippi River. 2, Genet was to commission American merchant vessels through letters of marque as privateers to war on British shipping. And if possible, 3, Genet was to persuade the Washington administration to join France in a national pact in which the two peoples would amalgamate their commercial and political interests. Genet arrived in Charleston on April 8, 1793, to a tumultuous reception. A reception which convinced Genet that he had only to nudge Washington's elbow, to prod the old gentleman into compliance with the French Republic's wishes. And so he issued letters of marque for 4 privateers, dropped hints that he planned to excite the Canadians to free themselves from the yoke of England, and even paid to outfit a captured British ship, the Little Sarah, as a 14-gun French revolutionary brig, the Petite Démocrate. Washington erupted when he learned of Genet's activities, forbidding the Petite Démocrate to leave port. Genet responded, in a colossal breach of diplomatic protocol, by announcing that he would appeal over Washington's head to the American people as a whole. is the minister of the French Republic to set the acts of this government at defiance with impunity, Washington raged, and then threaten the executive with an appeal to the people? It did nothing to endear Genet to Washington that Genet allowed himself to be elected president of one of the Republican societies, or that Jefferson, as Secretary of State, had been an audience to Genet's schemes. To Washington, Genet posed the twin threat of starting wars with both Spain and England at a time when the Americans were barely starting to be able to pay their own bills. To Hamilton, Genet was the symbol of a revolution gone awry, an awryness following the same principles which had nearly brought down the American Revolution under the Articles of Confederation. And Hamilton did not hesitate to mimic the organization of the societies by encouraging Rufus King and John Jay to sponsor anti-Genet rallies in New York and New England. Jefferson, struggling to disentangle himself from Genet, announced his resignation as Secretary of State at the end of July 1793. Washington persuaded him to delay it until the end of the year, and Jefferson relented. But the societies were another matter. Washington saw in the societies only the clubs that had toasted Citizen Genet. And he warned Light Horse Harry Lee, his old Revolutionary Cavalry chief, that the societies, in league with Genet, desired nothing short of the subversion of the government of these states, even at the expense of plunging this country in the horrors of a disastrous war. So, when the protests over the whiskey excise finally exploded in violence in the summer of 1794, Washington was prepared to turn his full wrath on the tax protesters as the treasonous offspring of Citizen Genet and the first formidable fruit of the democratic societies. Federalists were a decided political minority in western Pennsylvania, which made wealthy John Neville, a veteran officer of the Revolution, the polar opposite of William Findlay. So it was natural that when, in July of 1794, a newly appointed federal marshal, David Lennox, arrived with 39 summonses for defiers of the excise to appear in federal court in Philadelphia, Lennox should turn to Neville for aid in serving his writs. Instead, Lennox and Neville were shot at. And on July 16th, a band of 50 armed men showed up at Neville's farm, Bower Hill, just southwest of Pittsburgh. Neville armed his slaves, barricaded himself in his house, and shooting began, leaving five of the attackers wounded. The next day, the attackers returned, now swollen to between 400 and 800. Neville fled, and Bower Hill was burnt to the ground. A week and a half later, on August 1st, an angry mass meeting of 7,000 whiskey rebels was called at Braddock's Field, urging defiance of the excise and promising to march on Pittsburgh. The most hot-headed of the rebels, David Bradford, one of the leaders of the Mingo Creek Democratic Republican Society, openly called for secession from the Union and praised the French system of terror as a means of intimidation. The connection to the society has explained everything to Washington and Hamilton. The Pennsylvania Democratic Republican societies had been eager in denouncing the excise for the ruin of many individuals and the impoverishing of the country. And similar riotous meetings had occurred in Morgantown and Martinsburg, Virginia. This had one meaning for Washington. The whiskey rebels had been given every lenient measure. Their continued defiance could only mean that they were actually being manipulated by Genet and his French minions to sow the seeds of jealousy and distrust of government. On August 7th, Washington issued a proclamation announcing that the very existence of government and the fundamental principles of social order were in jeopardy, and calling for the services of the militia of Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Virginia, and Maryland to assemble at Carlisle, Pennsylvania, where Washington himself proposed to take direct command with Alexander Hamilton as his second in command. William Findlay was no lover of the excise, but he also had no desire to see property destroyed or have his western Pennsylvania district become a theater of civil war, especially at the hands of the vast mass of undisciplined men who would compose Washington's army. He talked the rebels into appointing him as an emissary to meet with Washington at Carlisle. And when Findlay arrived there on October 9th, as the militia was massing in force, Washington received him with politeness and attention. Findlay promptly blamed the entire outburst on Hamilton and accused Hamilton of having used the excise to provoke the frontier and inflame the army in a high degree. But Findlay also insisted that he spoke for the majority of western Pennsylvanians, not the most ignorant and obstinate class of people, in expressing unfeigned satisfaction at Washington's response, and he assured the president that in future the laws would be obeyed and the officers protected. Washington was not entirely mollified, and the march on Pittsburgh began on October 12th. But at every point, Washington encountered not resistance, but cheers and hospitality. And on October 20th, Washington had grown sufficiently confident that no fighting would occur that he turned over command to Hamilton and to Light Horse Harry Lee of Virginia and returned to Philadelphia. In the meantime, Findlay managed to isolate the hotheads like Bradford and persuade the rank and file of the rebels to disperse. 20 of the rebels were eventually arrested. 2 were convicted of treason, but pardoned by Washington. As he explained to Congress in November, the real culprits were certain self-created societies. And in Congress, Fisher Ames attacked political clubs who arrogantly pretended to be the people. The Great Whiskey Rebellion was over, more with a whimper than a bang. In retrospect, it has been easy to dismiss the Whiskey Rebellion as a tempest in a teapot, if not a whiskey barrel. Jefferson joked that an insurrection was announced and proclaimed and armed against and marched against, but could never be found. But Washington had a point worth hearing when he warned back on August 10th that if the laws are to be so trampled upon with impunity, and a minority is to dictate to the majority, there is an end, put at one stroke, to Republican government, and nothing but anarchy and confusion is to be expected hereafter. Anarchy and confusion was what had prevailed under the Articles. Anarchy and confusion were what the Constitution had been designed to dispel. But anarchy and confusion could still gain the upper hand if the lessons of the Confederation were forgotten so quickly. Washington may have been wrong about a Genet-inspired conspiracy at work in western Pennsylvania. The Whiskey Rebels were, after all, landowners who simply objected to having more pieces of their property prized away from them through the tax than they thought fair. They were not breadless sans-culottes from the Parisian streets. All the same, Washington did have to reckon with the possibility that on the other side of the Appalachians, the Spaniards still controlled the Mississippi Valley. And disgruntled Westerners might decide that their interests dictated a shift of their political allegiance closer to where their economic interests might lay. One thing Washington could at least take satisfaction from, the self-created Democratic-Republican societies dissolved in embarrassment over the Whiskey Rebellion like melting snow. The problem was that the spirit of party, of which they had been a symptom rather than a cause, was ready to assume a newer and more intense form.